You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From Milwaukee to Marshfield, where passion meets purpose and policy meets people, this is the Maggie Dawn Show.
We, as Republicans, as Democrats, as independents, as liberals and conservatives,
get ready to challenge the status quo with a fresh perspective on the issues that matter to you.
If it was bad before today, I cannot believe how much worse it has gotten.
If we don't band together and protest, our democracy will be gone.
Breaking down the complex world of policy and politics with clarity, conviction, and just the right amount of fun.
And I'm freaked the frickin' frack out.
Lawyer, economist, and fearless advocate for the truth, here is Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everybody. Happy Monday to you across the Civic Media Talk Radio Network. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, if you were listening on Friday, we had a lovely plan of a show for you. And then Stephen Miller stood on the White House lawn and said, hey, why don't we just suspend that pesky habeas corpus thing? Perhaps it was because the Supreme Court, in a 9-0 decision, about a month and a couple of weeks ago, said that habeas corpus was the single way for someone being detained pending deportation had to challenge that they couldn't use other mechanisms. There were other cases with other mechanisms going on. They said, no, only has to be, can only use habeas. And secondly, they said, again, 9-0, that you need and must provide due process. These are distinct concepts, but due process is the legal proceedings by which someone would try to bring forward their habeas corpus claims. We don't need to know Latin. Habeas corpus means the right of an individual to protest the government's detention, their seizure of their person. That is what habeas corpus is about. As I have said to you many a time, if there is one thing that separates democracies from everything else, it is due process. The corollary of that is habeas corpus, to protest your detention by the government. If you cannot do this, if habeas corpus is suspended, and we've got a couple of great guests today to help us understand what does this mean, what's next, can Trump actually do this? If habeas corpus is suspended, it means this. Masked government agents can come into your house, seize you, and take you to places unknown without ever listing the charges against you, allowing you to call a lawyer, and they can keep you for an undetermined amount of time without you ever being able to talk to family, a lawyer, or getting yourself heard in a court of law. In other words, they can disappear your butt forever or as long as they would choose to. That's what we're talking about. Democracies don't do these things. I'm really pleased, as I do now every Monday, I am joined by my colleague in broadcasting, Matt Rothschild. He has a wonderful podcast you can find on the Civic Media website and anywhere you get podcasts, called Wisconsin Forward. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hey, good afternoon, Maggie. It's always good to join you on Monday afternoons. Been looking forward to it.
Yes, this is quite a day. And Matt and I are very, very privileged to have with us UW-Madison Professor Emeritus Howard Schwaber. Welcome to the program, Dr. Schwaber. You have so many degrees, it's almost hard to keep track of them all. Let me briefly credential you, but I'm sure the salience of your discussion this afternoon will be sufficient to all. A PhD from Cornell University in Government, an MA from the University of Chicago in History, that school just a little south of us here, a JD from the University of Washington Law School, and your undergrad from the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome. You teach political science. You've taught in the law school. You're the guy to have on Monday after, you know, maybe we'll get rid of habeas corpus. Welcome to the program, Howard.
Wow. Thank you for having me.
It is indeed a wow. Let's start with this. Was my colloquial explanation of what a suspension of habeas corpus is, was that generally accurate? That's what it means if it goes away.
Well, I think it was more than accurate. In fact, I think you used the key term, which is sometime in the 1980s, we in the Western Hemisphere learned to use the word disappear as a verb. Mm. Disappearing people is something that I first heard about in the Latin American context. People were snatched off the street and simply never heard of again. And it was simply that your husband, your wife, your friend, your child, your parent went to work one day and just didn't come home, and that was it. You never heard anything else. Historically, the idea that that might happen and the idea that that is in some way the worst possible abuse of rule of law there could be is really old. It's not at all the 1980s. It goes back to the 16th century. Habeas corpus comes from English common law, as I know that you know. It was called the Great Writ. And I really want to emphasize a crucial point here. The point of habeas corpus is actually not to protest, but it literally means produce the body. And what it means is, and this is British originally, if the King of England's agents seized somebody, there was a way, and the name for that way was courts and law, to require that person be produced, prove that, it's sort of like in a hostage situation, proof of life.
Yes.
Show us the person, prove to us you have the person, and now make some justification for why you're holding them. The reason that's so important, there are two reasons that's so important. Number one, this is very deep-seated in Anglo-American law. It's a very deep-seated in the principles of the American Constitution. It's about as fundamental as it gets. And if you, at the moment we have Stephen Miller bloviating, but if this actually became something that President Trump started to do, I would argue that it would not be inappropriate to start using an 18th century term, tyrant, which I have to be honest, I don't think is appropriate. I've resisted people who've used words like fascism to describe this administration. I think it's an exaggeration. But this would cross precisely that line in that mind in a way that's at least 300 years old in our history. The second point about all that, or third, I've lost track, frankly, is that Stephen Miller presented this in a very cute, if you like, verbal kind of way. He said, well, we're thinking of suspending habeas corpus with respect to immigrants. That's meaningless. And the reason that's meaningless is exactly the same as the reason why it's meaningless to say we don't need trials for criminals whom we know are guilty. Trials are places you find out questions of fact, like is somebody guilty of a crime? Hearings are where you find out questions of fact, like is someone an illegal immigrant? If you can't have a hearing, then the fact that you're an American citizen, hypothetically, is not any protection at all against being seized because you never get to raise, you literally never get to raise the point that they've got the wrong person. Maybe it's a mistaken identity, right? Maybe it's an erroneous suspicion. It doesn't matter. So the suspension of habeas corpus cannot be limited. You can't say we're suspending habeas corpus as to X group of people. By definition, if you suspend habeas corpus, what you're taking away is the possibility of saying, hey, I'm not part of that group of people. Aside from anything else, have I committed a crime? Or am I the person named in this warrant or anything else?
Folks, that is Professor Howard Schwaber of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Howard, I want to elevate two things that you said. When habeas corpus is suspended, it doesn't matter who you are. Your status as a citizen becomes irrelevant because you could never complain because you're not entitled to have your person in a courtroom to say, hey, you made a mistake. Not only am I not a criminal, I am a citizen, and so I shouldn't have been disappeared, now using that as you started as a verb. That's what's critical here. It's either on or off, and it creates risk for all when habeas corpus is suspended.
Well, that's right, and it's not even just that. You can't even say you have the wrong person. You can't say anything. There's no opportunity. This is something that, by the way, I mean, I should acknowledge, we should all acknowledge, it has happened in American history four times. Most famously, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus for Confederate sympathizers in the North in the early part of the Civil War. And the Supreme Court eventually said, no, you can't do that. That was wrong. I want to acknowledge, the court said that only after the war was over. But Lincoln went back to Congress and got authorization. Let's not overstate this. It's not that habeas corpus can never be suspended. During the Bush administration, we saw exactly the suspension of habeas corpus attempted as part of the war on terror. It can be suspended. It's been tried before. But it has to be done by Congress. In the past, the Supreme Court has stood up and said anything less than that is not acceptable. Historically, it is only in cases of most extreme possible emergency that habeas corpus suspension can be justified. And it is an extraordinarily extreme move. To have an action like that declared, at least putatively, unilaterally, by a president when we're not at war, without the cooperation of Congress, well, I used the word tyrant before, and I want to reiterate, I have tried to resist what I think is sometimes overheated rhetoric by the critics of President Trump. But I think with respect to Mr. Miller, it's very hard to overstate the extent to which his statements are threats to the constitutional rule of law.
Professor Schwaber, Matt Rothschild here. And you mentioned his cute language, Stephen Miller, who's deputy chief of staff, I believe. So it's not like he's a nobody in the Trump administration. He was cutesy with his language in another way, in that he said, well, we might do this if the judges don't rule the right way, essentially. So he was telling the Supreme Court, you know, have our back on this one so we don't have to go do this unilaterally. Did you see that kind of cutesy move too?
Oh, it's actually, I mean, there's a lovely, I hope it's clear in a very sarcastic way. There's an echo here. We believe in elections as long as we win.
Yes.
This is exactly the same logic. Trump, so it's interesting. A lot of my colleagues have spent a lot of time talking about the phrase constitutional crisis. Are we in one? Is one coming? What would be the trip line? And a lot of people think, well, the line would be if Trump ever overtly defied a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, which he has not done. Up until then, he and his administration have evaded rulings. They've appealed rulings, which of course they're entitled to do. They've disputed rulings. But he's always been very careful and very, you know, to say, including his Meet the Press interview a few days ago, well, of course, we'll abide by the U.S. Supreme Court. Miller is laying down a gauntlet. And let's be clear, President Trump has not said this. Stephen Miller said this. But Miller laid down a gauntlet and said, essentially, even if the Supreme Court, I'll put it the other way, if the Supreme Court were to rule against us, we would act unilaterally to simply say law, we're in a no-law zone. We're in a state of exception here where law does not apply. That's, even by the standards of recent politics, deeply shocking.
It's interesting to me, Professor, because in that statement, I thought Stephen Miller gave away the game a little bit. Here's what I mean. He admits it's not the judicial review. It's not the act of providing due process to pending deportees that is the problem. It's simply the possibility that the government might lose, that their position is wrong. Like, that's what's triggering the potential suspension of habeas corpus, not the fact that the court is requiring due process. And I love the distinctions here, Professor Schwaber, of they're evading the Supreme Court's ruling. They're dancing around it. They're using very careful language to not outright contradict the ruling. They are deploying every rhetorical and linguistic, and it's not me, it's that other person that made the decision, trick in the book. Ladies and gentlemen, my name's Maggie Dawn. I got a great co-host with me today, Matt Rothschild. He's the host of Wisconsin Forward, a podcast on the Civic Media Network. We're joined by UW Professor Emeritus Howard Schwaber, political scientist, lawyer. You're not going to want to go anywhere. We continue to discuss, what does habeas mean to you? Does it matter in your day-to-day life? And what was all this bluster from Stephen Miller really about? Keep it locked right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Monday to each and every one of you. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's Monday, so I've got a great guest co-host with me. His name is Matt Rothschild. He is the host of Wisconsin Forward, a podcast you can find on the Civic Media website, but also everywhere that you like to find your podcasts. It is fantastic, if I do say so myself. Matt and I are very happy to bring to all of you our special guest this Monday, Professor Howard Schwaber of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, political scientist, lawyer, and good thinker, and more important for these purposes, a good explainer of things. We've been talking this half an hour about Stephen Miller's seemingly offhanded comment late on Friday that maybe the Trump administration will wave its magic wand and suspend habeas corpus, something that entitles every single person in this country, if they are detained by the government, to be brought forward, literally the very physical body, their body, brought forward into a court so they can challenge the basis under which the government is detaining them and depriving them of their freedom. Let's listen to what exactly Deputy Chief of Staff and Chief Domestic Policy Advisor to the White House, Stephen Miller, said on Friday.
Well, the Constitution is clear, and that, of course, is the supreme law of the land, that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended in a time of invasion. So I would say that's an option we're actively looking at. Look, a lot of it depends on whether the courts do the right thing or not. At the end of the day, Congress passed a body of law known as the Immigration Nationality Act, which stripped Article III courts, that's the judicial branch, of jurisdiction over immigration cases. So Congress actually passed, it's called jurisdiction stripping legislation. It passed a number of laws that say that the Article III courts aren't even allowed to be involved in immigration cases. Many of you probably don't know this. I'll give you a good example. Are you familiar with the term temporary protected status, or TPS, right? So by statute, the courts are stripped of jurisdiction from overruling a presidential determination or a secretarial determination on TPS when the Secretary of Homeland Security makes that determination. So when Secretary Noem terminated TPS for the illegals that Biden flew into the country, when courts stepped in, they were violating explicit language that Congress had enacted, saying they have no jurisdiction. So it's not just the courts aren't just at war with the executive branch, the courts are at war, these radical rogue judges, with the legislative branch as well too. So all of that will inform the choices the president ultimately makes. Yeah.
Oh, Lord. So much there, Professor Schwaber. Let's start with this concept of, well, as it relates to immigration, Article III courts and judges have absolutely nothing to do here at all whatsoever. They might as well just pack up their crayons and go home. This is just the exclusive province of the president and the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Secretary Kristi Noem. I explained this on Friday. That's hogwash. It was the process that is within the executive branch as to the individual hearings related to immigration status. It was thought to be too burdensome in the Article III courts, but that the Article III courts, of course, retain jurisdiction over fundamental constitutional questions, such as the suspension of habeas corpus, whether or not that would be constitutional, such as whether or not detainees pending deportation are entitled to due process. They are. Professor Schwaber, please give people a more fulsome explanation, since you are the expert here and I am but a mere radio host these days.
Well, I hate to be snarky.
No. Please do. We do a lot of snark around here. It's welcome.
You know, a few years ago, I had a standard line when talking about things that politicians or political officials say was, well, would this, you know, be a pass? Would this get a passing grade on exam in a first year law school class? Stephen Miller's comments wouldn't get a passing grade in AP government high school class. So we're at a whole different level. And the problem is, if you say something sufficiently wrong, it can take a long time to unpack it. Okay, I'm sorry. Let me just dig in. First,
it's so wrong, you need many minutes to explain.
That's the problem. You know, and that's actually one of the things that the Trump administration does. And it does things that are so radical and so bizarre. It is much easier to say something extraordinarily wrong than it is to explain all the ways that it is wrong. And in court arguments, they use this as an actual affirmative legal strategy. We can come back to that if we have time, but there are some really interesting examples. that caused me to think that this is a deliberately chosen strategy. But let me back to the subject. So what Miller is referring to is the fact that there are what are called Article II courts. Article II is the executive branch. Immigration matters were turned over by the statute, as he correctly states, passed by Congress to these special executive branch courts. And as you said, precisely for the reason that there were just too many of them for the regular, ordinary, what we call Article III courts, that's the federal court set up by Article III of the Constitution, to handle. That's all fine as far as it goes. But to save time, let me just go back to the early 1980s when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in one of the most important separation of powers cases in our lifetimes called INS versus Chadha, that every law student knows. The key terms there is INS. The Immigration and Naturalization Service was involved in a case. The question for the court was the interaction between the president and the Congress with respect to a ruling by an immigration court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, an Article III court, ruled on the question of the constitutionality of that arrangement. That should just make this all go away. Yes, it is true that the adjudication of individual immigration cases are handled by these special Article II courts, but questions of constitutional law, separation of powers, due process, anything arising under federal law or the U.S. Constitution is, under Article III, part of the jurisdiction of the federal courts, which lead ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court. Habeas corpus is very specifically part of that.
That is Professor Howard Schwaber. I've got a fine guest, co-host Matt Rothschild. I've got a fine guest. We are dissecting all of the myriad ways that what Stephen Miller said on Friday is incorrect. And let's get into what Professor Schwaber discussed, which is they get it so wrong that it becomes nearly impossible to unpack and explain. That is part of the Trump administration's strategy, specifically in courtrooms. You're going to want to keep it locked. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Stay with us. My name is Maggie. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a great co-host with me. His name's Matt Rothschild. You can find his podcast, Wisconsin Forward, on the Civic Media website, Spotify, and Apple Pods. Check it out. I know I give a listen to it whenever he comes out with a new episode. We've got a fine guest with us, Professor Howard Schwaber. He's with the University of Wisconsin, Madison, political scientist, attorney. We're helping to unpack not just Stephen Miller's sort of nonsense bomb from Friday afternoon, but more broadly, this is a very typical and highly consequential pattern in the Trump administration. That is to make an argument or take a policy action and then justify it with pretty much an A to Z litany of all arguments that are incorrect. At the same time, do all kinds of things. So the things that they're doing, the policy, so much, so fast, all wrongly justified, so that people who are trying to debunk that and respond to it can hardly keep up. Professor Schwaber, before we went to break at the bottom of the hour, you discussed this as a specific tactic. And ultimately, there isn't an intersection with the Supreme Court and how the court will handle these cases bubbling up through the circuit courts. But let's talk about it a bit as a policy strategy and a legal strategy and tactic. How have you been viewing this since the administration's blunderbuss approach first blew up on January 21st?
Yeah, you looked at it's also a political tactic.
Yes.
Right. So there's so much to talk about here. It goes back to a famous comment by Steve Bannon some time ago, flood the zone with stuff, although that's not the word that he used. There have been 200 judicial rulings putting a hold on Trump administration actions in 128 cases. There we go. Mm. In 43 cases, policies have been approved. And there are 140 more which we're still waiting for rulings. Those numbers are bizarre. And the Trump administration makes use of that fact. Look, we've had more injunctions than any presidency in history. This proves the judiciary is out of control. Of course, it proves nothing of the sort. What it proves is that the Trump administration has very deliberately pushed the boundaries of the court system's capacity. There is no possibility that the U.S. Supreme Court can rule on 200 lower court rulings between now and the end of May. It's not going to happen. It can't. I just saw a story today about a court of appeals putting a hold on an injunction by a lower court. It doesn't matter what the topic was. You can read one of these stories
every day. Yeah.
And the court system works slowly. It's designed to. One of the strategies the Trump administration has taken on is to deliberately do an enormous range of things that are unlawful. And I need to come back to that in a second. Knowing that there's no way that the Congress is not willing to stop them because it's dominated by Republicans, and the courts simply can't. Courts are effective potential constraints, but they move slowly. It'll be next year, you know, or after the war is over, in the case of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, that we finally get a statement. In the meantime, people are sitting in jail cells. Secondly, politically, from January 21st, and I've been watching this closely, and it fascinates me. Every time the Trump administration has a victory, they move the goalposts. That is, they take a more extreme position. In politics, there's a phrase, the Overton window, which is just a cute phrase for what is a plausible argument. In legal terms, it's the on-the-wall versus off-the-wall legal arguments. And as the window moves, right, what counts as normal moves. So a position that was once extreme is now normal, and so on. Miller's comment about habeas corpus that we were talking about, I don't think he would have said that in February. I think this is a matter of him moving the goalposts, saying something more extreme, because between then and now, they've laid some groundwork for declaring judges should be impeached and for declaring court should be closed down and for declaring, oh, we abide by the Supreme Court, but also declaring we don't need to abide by lower court judges. Coming back to something I alluded to earlier, one of the very core strategies of the Trump administration is to do things that are unlawful, that is, violate federal law, on the grounds that they think that those laws are unconstitutional by their particular theory, and they're waiting for the Supreme Court to say so. I know we don't have time for this, but the name of the theory is the unitary executive. That's a stretch. So we have three strategies. One is flood the zone. One is deliberately violate laws that you think are contrary to your constitutional philosophy and think you wanted the Supreme Court. And one is move the window of what's remotely acceptable political rhetoric by constantly pushing the goalposts toward more and more extreme directions. I think we should start calling it the internet or the cyberspace form of political discourse, right? Think of an algorithm. Mm-hmm. All those three things are going on, and all of them meet in this discussion about habeas corpus.
Professor Schwaber, I appreciate that analysis. It's like they want to get one fait accompli after another, and they're moving the discussion ever into more dangerous territory. But I just want to put a bow on our discussion here, Stephen Miller, or two bows. The first bow is, look, neither Congress nor the president can overrule the Constitution. That's been a doctrine here in the United States for 200 years, Marbury versus Madison. Number two, this isn't just Stephen Miller sticking his neck out, because CNN has a report saying President Donald Trump has been personally involved in discussions inside the administration over potentially suspending habeas corpus. And then they quote something from Trump on April 30th, where he says there are ways to mitigate bad decisions on deportations, for instance, and there's some very strong ways to do it, Trump told reporters. There's one that's been used by three very highly respected presidents, but we hope we don't have to go that route. But there is one way used successfully by three presidents, he repeated, and hopefully we don't have to go that way, but there are ways of doing it. So, you know, this is obviously on Trump's mind that they'll just unilaterally say habeas corpus out the window. It's crazy.
Oh, there's no question. Look, we've been talking about Stephen Miller because he made the quotation to the press that caught the attention, but he doesn't make this stuff up on his own. I don't think Trump is a great theorist who comes up with these ideas, but he hears something that strikes his fancy, and he repeats it. Famously, whoever the last person in the room was, and famously, Miller is lately the last person in the room. Let's not even get into that sort of psychodynamic of the Trump White House. You need a different expert. I'll be honest, I wouldn't listen to that show. I just couldn't. But let me back up a second, because there are some big points here. First, we ought not to pretend that habeas corpus is some sort of I should have had a good metaphor. I don't. I'm sorry. Some inviolate principle that has never been questioned before. Over the last 20 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has dramatically weakened habeas corpus protections for criminal defendants, for example. The conditions, the timing, and the grounds on which people, even facing the death penalty, can bring habeas corpus petitions have been narrowed repeatedly and consistently by conservative justices, and especially by the Roberts Court. Secondly, one of the presidents, to whom Trump may have been referring, I don't know, who tried to narrow habeas corpus was George W. Bush. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court actually pushed back. There are three cases involving detainees held at Guantanamo. The most famous is Boumediene versus Bush, but there are three of them. And taken together, they stood for the proposition that neither the president nor Congress, which is important, could simply take habeas corpus away altogether for an entire class of defendants. But Congress can, and in the past has, limited habeas corpus. So, again, the U.S. Supreme Court is not a great champion of habeas corpus in our lifetime. Congress has a history of trying to, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, stopped by the courts, stripping habeas corpus. The one proposition that makes this all so extraordinarily radical is that a president, and to be fair, George W. Bush did try to assert the same thing, but was slapped down, is that a president acting on his own initiative can unilaterally declare whether habeas corpus applies or not just because he says so. Earlier in the broadcast, I used a very, very loaded term. I used the term tyrant. I was recently rereading the Declaration of Independence. I know this gets to be kind of, do we really need such overheated references? And we don't. But it is the point is worth making that an individual government official with the power to unilaterally declare that people can be seized without any opportunity of a hearing of any kind is getting really close to the model of rule that the American constitutional system is entirely designed to resist.
Entirely designed to resist.
Yeah, no, I'll stand with that.
Yeah. I have been struggling, Professor, to find that phrase for a long time, right? Contrary, antithetical to our foundational principles, the very principles, the values outlined in the Declaration of Independence. Ironically, of course, the suspension clause was in the Constitution, which was written before the various different constitutional documents like the Bill of Rights. But this is where we're at. It is contrary to the very principles that our country was founded upon.
Forgive me for interrupting, but you just
please
alluded to me that's really important. The Constitution does not declare the principle of habeas corpus. Mm. It declares a suspension clause. The principle was so taken for granted, so fundamental, so part of the background of understanding that the thing the Constitution specified was the limited circumstances and mechanism by which you could ever not
have it. It's so critical, just to reemphasize what the Constitution, it presumes the constant existence of habeas corpus. So it only specifies when it can be suspended, and it is limited. The framers were deeply, deeply concerned about this particular element.
Absolutely.
As someone who grew up studying Central and South American governments, U.S. Interventions therein throughout, right, the 70s and 80s. Yeah, someone getting disappeared, very much a thing that I spent quite a bit of time studying that was alarming to me. Never did I think it would be a possibility. Here, we've got Professor Howard Schwaber from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've got guest co-host Matt Rothschild. We could spend all day on this, Professor. It is endlessly important, both important and interesting. I do want to ask you about another constitutional provision, which, I mean, silly me, I thought almost anyone could read and understand what it means. But apparently we've got some confusion on this point. And that is this fancy word, emoluments, and the emoluments clause. Tell people what it is, and then we'll get to why it's so important today.
Yeah, so this is where you have to work really, really hard to not be cynical. The emoluments clause. So first of all, shame on you, Ms. Dawn, for the foolish presumption that you can simply read words and know what they mean. That's not how lawyers work. The emoluments clause is a clause in the Constitution which has a really simple purpose. A president may not accept gifts. And the reason that could not be more obvious, a president should not be subjected to foreign bribery. And the circumstances and context could not be more obvious. European history was full of kings and emperors receiving lavish gifts of treasure. Have you ever seen the movie The Maltese Falcon? Tribute, it was called. And we didn't want to have that. I see we're on a break. I'll happily pick this up when we come back.
Yeah. Again, I can just turn over the keys to the show. We've got Professor Howard Schwaber with us, who knows how to anticipate a little time out of breath, if we will, here. This is a short one, ladies and gentlemen, so you're going to want to come right back with us. What about that beautiful luxury hotel in the sky? Does that run afoul of the emoluments clause? We discuss next. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, my friends. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I got a great guest co-host with me. He's been very patient because we've been having a lot of Q&A with our special guest for this whole first hour, UW-Madison Professor of Political Scientist and Law, Howard Schwaber. He is, as I said, a historian, a political scientist, and a lawyer here to help us understand all of the crazy that is basically every day, every hour of the day coming from the Trump administration. Professor, the emoluments clause, it has it's short-ish as constitutional provisions go, but it basically says no person holding any office shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any gifts of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. It means the president can't take gifts from foreign countries. So is the, quote, palace in the sky that's coming Donald Trump's way worth some $400+ million from Qatar? That would seem to violate the emoluments clause, would it not?
Well, to answer that question, I should go back to last year, 2024, a case called Snyder versus United States, because when Karen Levitt, the White House press secretary, talked about this yesterday, it was really interesting how she began. She said, first of all, this gift of this jet is not legally bribery. And then she said, it also does not violate the emoluments clause. The reference to criminal bribery was kind of interesting. And I'm a little surprised that I have not seen the media pick up on that as, like, good heavens. And the answer is that last year, the U.S. Supreme Court, and we could have a whole show, and I'd love to, about the Roberts Court and the way it has empowered all of the behaviors by the Trump administration that some of us disapprove of course, people can disagree. Last year, they ruled that not just for the Trump administration, for all politicians, it's not a bribe if you pay someone after the fact that they did something.
Yeah, if it's a tip, it's a tip. It's fine. Good service. Thank you. Here you go.
A gratuity is exactly the analogy that they used, or an expression of appreciation. So if a politician passes a law that gives I'm making this up now. This is not specific. But you own a casino and gives your casino an exemption from all environmental regulations, and the next day you make a $500,000 donation to their campaign, that's not a bribe, which is astonishing. A long time ago, a guy named Daniel Patrick Moynihan coined a phrase defining deviancy down. It was a different context, but over the last 20 years, we've seen the courts define corruption down. At this point, the only way to engage in legal bribery is to not only pay somebody, a politician, an official, to pay them to do a specific act ahead of the act with the explicit statement this payment is returned for doing that act. Anything less than that doesn't count. And that's what Levitt the press secretary, explicitly referred to in her statement to the public. She said, well, there was no payment for a specific act. And again, the fact that that's the bar for a president ought to be the real story here. But the Emoluments Clause comes in second. The Emoluments Clause was the constitutional framers' way to try and get around, they thought, any such attempt to be clever and say, look, you just can't take gifts. Just let's not even have this issue. No U.S. government official can receive gifts, tributes, gold coins, treasures, for the very, very obvious reason that there exists a blatant potential for conflict of interest. If I give you, you know, a giant golden statue, maybe you'll be better to me in a trade negotiation. Well, one of the patterns we've seen from the Trump administration is that they've taken areas in which past administrations, bipartisan administrations, Democratic and Republican administrations, have been loose and said, well, hey, if you guys were loose with it, we're driving a truck through it.
Yeah.
So the Clinton Foundation was very sketchy with this stuff, because if I give money to your foundation, is that not something you will personally appreciate? So that could that not influence your attitudes toward me? And Hunter Biden, now he was lying, it appears, but went around trying to sell access and taking money for it. And on the Republican side, there's just simply no shortage, going back at least the Nixon administration, probably much longer, of people making business deals. But the Trump administration has taken this to a level really we've never seen before. Donald Trump Jr. formed an investment fund 2 days after the inauguration that has invested heavily, or accepted investments heavily, into companies including Elon Musk's companies that have contracts with the United States government and has profited tremendously from those contracts. Does anyone think that steering $10 million to Donald Trump Jr.'s fund, or nearly $1 billion in copyright and intellectual property titles to Ivanka Trump during the first administration, will not in any way cause Donald Trump to view with favor? Of course not. But we live in this world now of a bipartisan, well-earned cynicism and suspicion about the Emoluments Clause, and B, a lawyerly ability to say, hey, if it doesn't specifically cross what the courts have said, nothing counts. And so Trump has said, well, this isn't a gift to me. It's a gift first to the administration, the Defense Department. And then after I cease being president, it will be given to my library. I will fly around it for the rest of my life. But it wasn't technically, legally, officially a gift to me personally. So there's no reason the Constitution should care, because after all, that can't possibly be the basis for corruption.
Even the media is having a hard time deciding how to cover this. That was the amazing thing to me on this story. The New York Times talked about it in a headline. The subhead just said this raises substantial ethical issues. Right. Well, it was a little more than that.
I saw that. That was extraordinary. I really wish people would go back to the first part of Levitt's statement. This is not a criminal bribe. The fact that the press secretary...
You have to say it.
Right, the White House press secretary, and not, by the way, asked about it. You know,
right. No, just offers it up. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if it quacks, it has webbed feet, it has feathers and a duck bill, I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that it's a freaking duck. Just happens to be outright corruption. We cannot wait to have Professor Howard Schwaber back on the Maggie Dawn Show. What good fun. We have another amazing guest to talk to us about the crisis of childcare in Wisconsin. Coming up next, keep it locked right here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.